the genre that gravitates to me. You do quite a lot of action too. And a few years ago, you did Kill Fist with Sunny as well.
Yeah.
So is it a genre that you really liked and you sort of like learn how to do it well?
I learned how to do it well by practicing on my short films. Mm. Then we did one film together with Sunny called The Collector.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
Yeah, that was a fighting film. Yes, I think it's a genre that I like a lot, but it's not what of genre that the only genre that I want to. Like I said earlier, it's not something that this is what I want to do for the rest of my life. It's actually something that I enjoy as a kid. You know, we grew up watching a lot of this Jackie Chan, Donnie Yen, Jet Li films in the 80s, 90s, right? So it's always there. I wanted to do action films. I self-taught, so I worked closely with a lot of stunt and fight choreographer in Malaysia. And on top of that, because I like martial arts, you know, every kid in Malaysia might have done taekwondo and karate in their teens. So I'm one of those, you know, your parents just send you to some martial arts, hope you come back up becoming a disciplined kid. So I think those stuff was kind of like still in me. Even today, I am still interested in martial arts. My interests, I still train and practice with my friends. That's why I always wanted to make action film or fighting film. And I'm so a fan of like action films like gunfights that involve a lot of gunfights. John Woo, mm-hmm. right, from the era. Ringo Lam. And so war films. So I mean, guys, like, we all pants over to graduate to those genres, yep. youngest. Mm-hmm. But it seems until now, too, those are some things that I would love to do if I have an opportunity to do an action film. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, with The Collector, was your first action film?
Yes, it's the first proper, fully funded action film with Sunny Park. So, before that, we did short films, or I have like one or two action sequences in some horror or thriller movie. Yeah. And also when we do TV series, there was a lot of action involved. You know, TV series, sometimes they got all this gang fight or fist fight. So I managed to meet some stuntmen and learn from them. And eventually it's kind of like, actually, in fact, I learned a lot from this Hong Kong guy, Ma Yo Sing.
Mm.
So he used to be under Chin Ka Lok. Right? So he shot a lot of those 90s martial arts and Stephen Chow movies.
Mm.
Now he's in China. He's big time. I got an opportunity to work with him in 2010 or 11, I forgot. Right? In a movie that I don't want to mention about because it's a bad vibe. Anyway, I got to work with him in that project and I learned a lot from that guy. You know, how Hong Kong used to shoot their kung fu fighting films. It was hilarious. You know, how they are fast. They are very, how to say, resourceful. A lot of things are improvised on set and we heard a lot, but that was my first personal witness on set working with him.
Uh-oh, okay.
So on that, I learned a lot like, wow, this is how they shoot it. Of course, I wouldn't recommend people to shoot it like him because it's crazy, but I managed to grab some stuff to be part of my arsenal for shooting action films these days. Yeah.
Okay. Is it, when you did Collector, was there... What's the main thing you have to learn to do action as a director?
So I think a lot of film directors usually, which I think very common, you find reference films, right? A lot of scenes, then you show it to the team. And in this case, as an action, we find a lot of reference scenes that I want to use as a reference, but not copy, is it? So that's very different than copy and stealing, right? So I will select those scenes that I thought I want as a reference and then I'll share it with the stunt choreographer, the fight choreographer, and then see what he had, what he thinks and if he could do that and how long to train all this stuff. And then usually from there, we will try very hard to start to how you call, modify it bits and bits. You know, like you modify a car into something else, into a Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you modify the mudguard first, then you modify the door, the side mirror. And so it becomes something unrecognizable to the thing that we were trying to steal.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I was trying to learn in Collector. You know, basically all the fight scenes were fight scenes from some Hong Kong movies that I've seen before, you know, which I collected from YouTube. And then I just share and we discuss And then, but of course, not all we use it, because then the choreographer also did manage to put in some very original. There's been some fight scenes was original. Totally, it was from them. You know, because eventually you say, oh, we can do this. We don't have to do that, you know. So some of the shots, if you look at it, right, I can tell you this is a shot that I've seen it from these movies, you know. And I was also a fan of Chuck Norris and Van Damme and Steven Seagal too, back those days.
Yeah, no,
yeah. So everyone. That was, yeah, rare. Yeah, everyone was a fan of them. But today you watch back, it's really outdated, man. It's so slow. So a lot of the reference came from there. So it was a bit here, a bit there, but mostly it was from Hong Kong. So then that's how I actually learned to actually use reference and start from there. It's also the first time, which I know from that time in Hollywood, they have freebies. And somehow it never picked up in Malaysia, you know. Previous is like you shot it as how we will cut it based on the choreography. So the stunt guy will finalize the choreography. I'll say, yeah, this is what we want. Then they will get the actors to practice it, rehearse the choreography. And then once they're almost ready, the stunt choreographer, the fight choreographer will film it. At the time, if those are mini DV camcorder, right? We don't even have handphones. And then from there, she'll edit the final thing, that how it's supposed to look like in a final film. And so when we're on set, yeah, we shot very fast. We just shot as per previous, which I don't know why people do not want to spend time on that. Because that's how an action films save time, because you have previous. Basically, just go there, shoot a shot, and the actors just have to do like 2-3 takes of certain actions. So I really don't understand, and totally I disagree of shooting action like one long take, like 10 takes. You know, unless you're Park Chan-wook, you have the budget. But otherwise, if you're shooting a conventional action films, I think you always need to have cuts to have the impact. Then it's almost like when we are prepping for dialogue scenes, you already know how to cut what shots you need, right?
Okay.
Action sequence is the same. It's more complex because we don't understand the language of the movement. That's why we need a fight choreographer. So he'll tell me, this one, you need a high-speed shot. Okay, this back kick, you need to shoot from here. So I learned from him from that, like that. And of course, I learned more once I found from what I was saying. Because the problem is like a lot of DP doesn't know how to shoot action.
True.
Trust me.
True, true.
Yeah. And they have this, if they're not open-minded, they will try to shoot their own way. And usually, you can't cut it and it'll look awful. They don't know how to shoot the impact.
The other thing is, on DPs is that, have you seen any of the Singapore DPs works and admire from afar?
Yeah, I wouldn't remember the name. Like, I kind of like the whoever's operating camera for Yellowbird. It's a preference. Other than that, I see a couple of like commercial DPs work in from Singapore. When I was doing work there, they sometimes send DPs showreel. But some of them are actually Malaysian, so it's kind of strange.
They're in
Singapore.
Yeah, quite a lot of crew are from Malaysia. But the strange thing is that I'm sure there'll be a lot of DPs that'll be dying to work with you.
Oh, okay. I'm not sure. Yeah, it depends.
It's strange that we don't actually have a lot of cross-pollination of talents. Of course, for you to ask will be, I think, also it's quite scary, because even for us to hire our crew is a lot of people are, well, our crews are not that, it's not, how to say, our crews rates are,
I'm sure
for Malaysia it would be quite prohibitive, but I'm sure quite a lot of DPs and all that are also looking to work with very innovative directors and all that. So and I'm sure also a lot of DPs will be saying the same thing, which is like, all Singapore directors all want the same thing, or like, you know, they would like to try something else. Have you worked with any DPs from other countries before?
No, I don't. I don't have a opportunity because of the nature of most project and the scale of it. We wouldn't be able to afford like a DP from other countries.
Mm.
But I would love to if there's a opportunity in future.
Mm.
But basically, I think I'm kind of more inward looking. I prefer to work with like, if I'm now in Malaysia, I would prefer to work with more Malaysian crew or operation team. If I ever shoot anything in Singapore, I would prefer to work with a Singapore production team if they're not too costly. Because I think other than Singapore, because if I ever go there, I'll try to work with a Singapore team. But in Malaysia, I always feel like that there's a lot of talent.
Mm.
I haven't reached a stage which I think I need a foreign DP to come and help me shoot this thing. I am very confident to say whatever the foreign DP that we see outside, most of our Malaysian DP could do that too, right?
Mm.
I feel like it's because they don't have the opportunity because of the nature of the world, the genre and the director they work with. I wouldn't say like a lot, maybe the Hollywood stuff, some of our DP can't do, but a lot of the stuff you see now worldwide from TVC, music video and films, right? They're actually not very hard to achieve by a well-informed, knowledgeable, experienced DP. You know, it's a technique they could learn. Mm. So I always feel like I want to work with a local team first, DP or music composing, sound engineer. I prefer to work with local guys. It's not because of cost. It's not because of they cost lesser or what. But I feel like in a way, I think it's quite a bit overstated to say I'm trying to support back the people in the industry.
Okay. I totally agree with that. I mean, because talking about looking inwards, the very first obvious thing we always do is we get the people that we know, right? And those people that we are close to or friends with. So it's not wrong to think of that. And also, even in Singapore's industry, I mean, our film industry, I think, is even younger than Malaysia's. So there's still a lot of talent to be harnessed and grown and to give opportunity so that we can grow and all that. I do get that. But I also get the sense of like, you know, because nowadays, you know, a flight costs less than a bus ride now.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
So in fact, I'm so glad that you agreed to do this podcast, because I would like to also cover Southeast Asia, because there's quite a lot of filmmakers coming from Myanmar, Vietnam, you know, from Indonesia, from Philippines. And I thought even as directors, I think it would be quite good to have some cross-pollination of resources. And sometimes it's seeing the difference and then you actually go back to, it's almost like sometimes you eat a lot of Japanese food, but then after a while, you still go back to your laksa and your, you know, the comfort food that you're used to. I just was just thinking, it's like, hey, stranger, how come no DPs will want to work with you? I mean, it's like, you know, definitely your star in Singapore, everybody heard know who you are. And we really do admire a lot of Malaysian filmmakers. So, but I think it's also good to, and I actually worked on a TV project in KL before. So that was four years ago, I think. Yeah.
Oh, that's not long.
Yeah, not long.
Just before pandemic.
Yeah, that was just before. Yeah. So we were in a town and then we worked totally with a Malaysian team, DPs to production, everything.
It's
everything.
A series, is it?
Yeah, it's a TV
series. Is it a series?
Yeah, series. So,
for MediaCorp.
Yeah, yeah. So, I totally enjoyed it. I thought, you know, the team was so strong.
Oh, okay.
They were so passionate about what they do. So I thought that, you know, sometimes we think that we are quite similar, but then also we are not that similar. And sometimes is this similarity and dissimilarity can produce very unique results.
Which part of Malaysia do you should be?
Just above KL. I forgot what's the town's name. Yeah.
It's still part of KL.
Yeah. No. 1 hour off. 1 hour off.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, the project is called Fried Rice Paradise.
What? Oh, Fried Rice Paradise. All right.
Yeah. So, I was there for nearly a month. Yeah. So it was interesting. I mean, it's like it feels more like a filmmaking village.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, because everybody has to stay there, right?
Yeah.
So instead of everyone just go home, it's a bit too far even for the Malaysian friends to go home.
Correct.
So it's a little bit more of like when I heard, you know, the earlier stories about Zhang Yimou with, like, you know, his last time when they were shooting in China, everything happens in their village and then they just
together.
Yeah. So, and you can get very different results rather than, for a lot of Singapore projects, it's very business on. It's like call time, and then the 1 minute after call time finishes, everyone's gone. Yeah, so it's very business, and so that's quite different. The working with actors, so when you work with actors, the process, do you do a lot of rehearsals? And rehearsals way before the shoot or on the shoot itself? A lot of Singapore, especially TV, is like this. We will like go to the place and then we just rehearse one time, two times, and then okay, go already. Yeah. That's TV.
TV, I think it's kind of quite similar. The luckiest we can get is a one reading with the actors doing pre-pro. But otherwise, it's kind of the same. We usually end up rehearsing on the set for TV shoot.
Mm.
But for feature films or my personal work, like my short films or indie stuff, I'll try to have more.
Mm.
But even in feature films, the max I can get is like 5 rehearsals, which is quite privileged, because most of the time the actors are busy and they are not being paid for rehearsals. So a lot of the actors sometimes feel like, when I work with actors who's committed, it's great that they are willing to show up to the rehearsals as per request. Like this recent film that I did, the firefighter films, they came in for the 5 days of rehearsals, which is quite rare, including the supporting actors and all the minor roles. They all came. So they're very dedicated. Personally, I would prefer, like most director, the more the better. But when I say the more the better, there's a cap. So if I could have maybe a week, a 7 days of rehearsal would be good for feature films. But the minimum, I need at least 2 or 3 days of rehearsal spread out. So we can do a 1 day and then spread out to after 2 or 3 days, they come back again. So they have time to process what we have done. The reason is like, I came from theater background and their rehearsal is very, very detailed and very, very intense. And theater, of course, you know, it'll take like 1-2 months to rehearse one play. Right? And then they perform for just 3 nights or 4 shows like that, you know, and that's why the performance is always better on theater. So it's actually impractical to bring that process in the film unless I have like multi-billion-dollar project, right? And you lock on the actors for 1 month. Otherwise, film, I try to make it like at least 3 or 2, preferably 7 rehearsals. I plan it so I try to achieve something within the rehearsals. Because for me as a director, I think rehearsal is also my work to make sure that every rehearsal that I already request, right, and the producer set for me, I need to make sure I achieve something in those rehearsals. If you give me 3 rehearsals, I need to make sure what I need to do in this rehearsal. If so bad they just give me 1 goddamn rehearsal, I need to make sure this 1 rehearsal, what I need to pinpoint. So at least I can feel confidence, all right, I know what to do. To me, rehearsals, mainly if I have 1 or 2 days, the only thing I focus is chemistry between the actors.
Mm.
That's all I could do. You know, two days, and you're not talking about the full day, you know, it's like 10 to 5 or 6, that's it. So usually if I get this type of type 2 or 1D rehearsals, I'll just focus totally on chemistry. Right? We have talked a bit about characters, but mainly I need to make sure that the main actors supporting or the lovers or people who interact with each other, I just want to check out their chemistry and work on that. That's, I think, the most important thing. This is something I discovered in theatre. In theatre, because of the long rehearsals, eventually everybody become very close. Yeah, because they got 1 month together, they see each other's face every night, and then, you know, they act together, they dine together, you know, sometimes. And I think there's a trust, and that's why theatre actors, they could perform so well because of the amount of time they spend with each other. And I think they build the trust and the chemistry. So for film, usually with this rehearsal, that's what I focus, the chemistry. Because most actors, I think, at least experienced actors, the scenes and dialogue is not a big problem. They can memorize it with no, you know, unless new actors, then there's problem. But most actors, they look at the script, unless you give them like 2-page monologue, then good luck. But otherwise, most script is very conversational, like, you know, it's 2-3 lines and then 3 paragraphs. I think it's not a very challenging job for actors. And I think actors should be able to handle those. You know, rehearsal is not for them to come and memorize script. That's definitely not part of what I look for in rehearsals. And on top of that, I'll run those very important scenes in a movie or in my short films. I'll just run those 2 scenes over and over again until I get the point. Because I believe sometimes when that scene becomes good, or at least what I want, and the actors know, oh, okay, this scene is like that, then they can understand their character better.
Okay.
Then I think eventually they will know how to play the rest of the actor, the characters, the script, in a more clear way. Of course, we might not touch up on set when we rehearse again. I think that's the only practical way to do a rehearsal for films, because we don't have the time. You know, I focus on chemistry and I focus on those few particular scenes that I think is the most important part in a movie. Because in a movie too, I always felt like there's always scenes that's not so important and scenes that are important. You know, it cannot be every scene in the 90 minutes important. Then it will be too hard to grasp, right? So usually I pick that out during pre-pro. Then I make sure these are the scenes that the actor needs to play. They need to play so well until they understand, oh, this is my character. And hopefully from there, they'll kind of, you know, bring it on. And the sad thing with film acting is that they are not in chronological order. So it's very challenging for the actors too, right? Yeah, so I have to deal with that too. So they know their mood and how to get there. So yeah, usually, and a lot of times when I try to build chemistry, it's a lot of improvisation.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot of acting exercise games for them to play as a character or as a non-character. Yeah.
Okay. Are you particular with the performance? That means it's like you rehearse and then when they do it, then you're like, no, you do it like this or you do it like that. Or you pretty much, whatever they prepare, you just am okay with that.
Yes, I have locked down during the rehearsals. They can't give me something else or I'll just say, no, this is not right.
Okay.
Or it's out of tone, right? Yeah, one more thing I need to add in rehearsals, so I try to kind of lock down the tone of the film. So the actors know what film they are in, you know, are they in an art house film where they don't have to speak for 5 minutes and have to express a lot? Or are they in a indie American film where there's a lot of dialogue and they have to talk very fast? You know? Or are they in a Hong Kong style film where they have to, you know, very overact a bit, you know? So I think that thing also I need to lock down very, very first. Like, I know it's a bit far-fetched. Like, this is a Malay film that I recently did. So my film of reference was Peter Berg, Deepwater Horizon. And most of the actors have watched it, you know, Mark Wahlberg, right, and Peter Berg. And they immediately go, oh, this is what we are going for. Yes, I say, yes, this is the tone of acting we are going for, not the quality we are going for. We can't afford that.
Okay.
So, yeah. So in a way, I'll find a film, tell them this is the tone, so everybody could mesh, so there's no overacting. So there won't be like suddenly a guy's doing a TV acting and the rest look very naturalistic. So usually I set a tone, and most actors are quite, with experience, they are quite versatile and smart. And then they see, oh, that's what we're going to do. And they can try to match it and that. So I have very less problem, like the acting style is a bit wrong on set.
Okay.
Except for those actors that's not part of the rehearsal, sometimes those happen. Yeah.
So how many... what kind of director are you? How many takes do you do? Like, you know, one take or like David Fincher, 70?
It really depends. But most of the time I try to limit it within 5 takes these days. Really, I don't see the necessity to go over so many takes unless it's a technical problem, you know, like sound problem, lighting problem, or a blocking problem, or camera suddenly jerk, and all these minor problems. Usually I kind of like give the actors, I tell them like, yeah, 3 takes, you're going to give me that because I don't want to waste time here. Retaking. And I tell them I'm not those are director. I want to take a lot so I can see different style, different version, which I always think is pointless because I still got like 10 more scenes to go. So I tell them this is it. And there's a script. They know the character. But even recently, there's a couple of times I have shoot until 19 takes because this actress, which is, it's not even like minor role. It's just like 3 scenes.
Okay.
But yeah, and there was technical problems and then there's an acting problem. Because sometimes in a film, right, those minor roles, I don't actually set them up. I only set the main actors, the characters. So a lot, I depend on a casting casting manager. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if they kind of like go easy on it, you get really very not qualified actors on set. And then I have to deal with that thing. So that one was 19 takes, including a technical mistake. That was the most I was like, whoa, holy shit. Mm-hmm. You know, even my actors doesn't have that much privilege to have so many takes. So that was the longest recently. But eventually sometimes it will be maybe 7 or 8 takes if there's some things that I need to perfect. But I think it's more of like a self-control thing. I need to remind myself, I need to have a cap, you know. But I think this is also because how I look at it as a business. You know? Yeah, because if you're running it like a business, like now I'm shooting commercial films, there's money involved. Everything got a cap. You know, if they say, hey, James, this movie is 10 million, you'll be like, wow, that's big. But eventually 10 million is not enough. You've eventually also run into a problem like you are running out of time, the money is spent somewhere. And you have 1 million, in the same case. Oh, it sounds like low budget and you have the same problem. So for me, whether it's a big budget or small budget, right, in filmmaking, you always have to problem, it's not enough time.
Yep.
You know? So yeah, so I think that's the thing that I always know. It doesn't mean like now I'm doing a 1 million ringgit indie film, I have to shoot 20 days, you know, because I got 1 million. It doesn't mean that when I have 5 million, I can shoot 100 days and take my time, like 4 days, one scene. It doesn't work like that in the industry. Still, there's a limitation. So I try to cap myself first to make sure so I don't want to spend too much time on the same thing again, unless, like I said, it's a technical problem, they could not get a take, or it's a sound problem. But this even for sound problem, I immediately, if I got a good performance, I go straight to dub. I say, let's dub it on the studio.
Okay. How's Malaysian actors with dubbing? Because in Singapore, I think it's not in our culture. So the skill level also is not there in dubbing Singapore. Okay. Yeah. Because if you, from what I know, if in the Western filmmaking, I mean, in Hollywood or whatever, it's a given they have to dub. So they actually do a lot of classes on dubbing. And even the directors also know how to direct dubbing because you can get another performance and all that. But in Singapore, in fact, it's quite difficult to actually get back the same acting.
Oh, okay. But I'm not sure because maybe in your side, your audio engineers seldom do it. But like here, when we do dubbing, our audio engineers, they are very good at that. They are the one actually try to, I would say, they are the one who's directing the dubbing. So sometimes I'm there just to supervise to make sure it's the same or I want something different. They will, because they are controlling the mixer and everything. And they can really listen to the sound more skillful than me, you know. I think I'm not sure why in your side you have less it, but in Malaysia, the dubbing is getting way better than 10 years ago, right?
Mm.
10 years ago, yes, but dubbing is very bad. It's out of sync, it doesn't match the mouth, right? The performance is a bit weird. But nowadays, our dubbing, my work, at least, they look damn good. Some of them, I can't even tell it was dubbed because my sound engineer, they thought the scene was too noisy. They're very particular, right? They dubbed the goddamn scene, right? Without telling me, because it's just the same thing, right? Then when I watch it, I say, wow, why now this sounds so better than the thing. They dubbed the whole thing because the scene was shot in near a river. So okay. We already know the river rushing sound is always a problem, right? But the sound guy on set did a quite good job, a very solid sound. But when we finished, it sounds way better. So I thought like, wow, it was a very good sound guy. He said, no, we redubbed the whole thing. They asked the actors to redub because they said they couldn't do much when the ambience they couldn't control it. Then they layered back the river sound on it. So I think our sound engineer, that at least those that I work with, I'm quite lucky. They are very professional and I think they like their job. So they put a lot of effort to make sure the thing turns out well. I think there's a difference between how a film could turn out good or bad or not good. I think even the post guys needs to be very dedicated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If they're just to do a job, do a balanced mix, you know, can hear, can listen, everything sounds nice. And then they just, like you say, okay, it's 5 p.m., let's go back. Mm. Then you'll get very average or mediocre work. But I'm quite lucky because most of my post guy, my musician, they are really more passionate than me when they are in it. You know, they're doing a lot of effort to say like, hey, okay, we can do this. They will recommend this stuff. Which for me as a director, I don't find it annoying. I find it like more enjoyable to see people giving me ideas how to do the sound or make the film much more better.
Mm.
Like, I know it sounds very, I'm not sure it sounds surprising, but a lot of my works are, when I'm not editing myself, when I have an editor, the cuts are done by them.
Mm.
Except for a few particular things that I really need. But generally the films is cut by them, even though I shot it as per script, they could turn it into something surprising for me.
Mm.
I always, when I'm with an editor, I say, okay, cut it as if you are watching the film. So I say, don't cut it as per script, right? I know eventually, if I don't like it, you have to recut the whole goddamn thing again, but cut it the way you see it first, because at least I can see your point of view as an editor. And a lot of times, it looks better than what I have shot.
Mm.
And that's true. Yeah, because if I try to cut it myself or ask them to cut it my way, I think they'll look like my film and how it is all the while. Because some of the edit they come up with sometimes surprising me, especially with the structure, even though a horror film, you write it linearly, right? They still can make it, cut it screw up the chronological order and it still looks good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because sometimes this sort of stuff, you have to write it first, because if not, it doesn't work.
Yep.
Yeah, but some editors, they are kind of like very sharp, very crazy. They'll try it and then it worked. And then I was like, wow, I didn't know this scene could be here. So, and I enjoy working with them like that because in a way I think I work less.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, getting a team that you admire and respect, you know, and everybody just puts in their A game, it becomes so much better than when you try to control everything.
Yeah.
To only your standard because you can't see anything beyond your standard.
Yes. And it took me quite a while to be able to work like that. I mean, I'm like most young filmmakers during my younger times, it's very precise. You know, I need to be like that. I need to be like that, right? But as you grow a bit older, more experienced, you learn to let go and appreciate the work of others.
Yes. Okay. Going back to Sunny, how was it working with Sunny in the beginning?
I think it's kind of same in your podcast. It was fun. It's kind of chill for the fact that we always have a perception that Singaporeans hard to deal with.
Okay. You
know, all Singaporean, they are more professional. They need this, need that. But he was quite cool, quite chill. Very easy to work with, and he could adapt with our working method. I think he, in your podcast, he told you how we met, right? Through the Facebook and everything.
Yeah.
Then he came over here, he met the rest of the Malaysian actors. We had a good time. because of the nature of the production. I think in a way, I'm not sure how to say this, but a lot of my actors that I usually, when I got into my production, eventually, if I set that atmosphere right, I think most of them can get into, like if Sunny can adapt and be chill, right? Because I really set it to be like that, you know, with the rest of our actors.
Mm-hmm.
I seldom run a tech ship. I don't run it like a gulag camp. You know? Like you are now in my production and you need to listen to me as an actor, right? I kind of like prefer them coming in as themselves, so I could kind of like at least find out who they are. And I usually have even in my commercial films, I run it damn chill. I want them to come in to enjoy themselves. And if the actor, most of the actors, they could do that because at the end of the day, they are human beings. Yeah? Yeah, not all of them are strict and like, I'm an actor. And then they have to, I did have some of these actors before in some of these Malay films I did. But eventually they too chill down because always they come in, they need to have that facade to show that they're professional because they don't know us. So there's always a layer to protect themselves. But eventually somehow when we shoot too, they will peel off and then they'll be in it. And I think for me, that's very important. But if an actor doesn't peel off and still have that barrier, I respect that too. You know, as long as he deliver, because I don't necessarily need him to adapt and be chill and relaxed with the rest of us, because some actors are very private and I would say introvert.
Mm. Okay.
They're much more introvert compared to me. You know, I've met actors like so introvert. I was like, whoa, all right. But when they act, they don't seem to be like an introvert. This is always this the thing with acting. What you see on screen is not real, right? In real life, they are a totally quiet person. They keep to themselves. You know, they're readable. They seldom like hang around, which is their personality, which is nothing wrong, right? I could respect them for that as long as they can deliver the performance. So in a way, I think, it depends on the actors, but usually I try to make it so everybody have fun and everybody can have a most important thing. They could relate to each other and build the chemistry together.
Okay. Yeah. So you were saying?
Yeah, so Sunny had that work. I mean, you're going before, he's quite open-minded to a lot of ideas, you know, even for his experience, the fact that he have acted or he have like done so many choreo, I think he would still open up for ideas. So it's not like he come in and he'll shut down and have a very strong opinion like, oh, I can't try this or I won't do that, which I always think this is the biggest mistake as a actor and director. You try to kind of like, I mean, one try to think this is what I want and this is how it should be done. It cut off the opportunity to look at something new. Because I feel like, yeah, maybe they can give me this idea. If I don't like it, I can still pull it back to what I want. Of course, in a way, the actor may feel like, oh, I waste some time, you know, but that's too bad. But that's how I work, you know. I would want to hear your opinion, but eventually I'll call the shot. Yeah.
Okay. I think obviously, even though you do many, many genres, but from maybe it's the times that you really got to be good in, like, of course,
yeah,
you also got a lot of bad habits, lah, because yep, you know, you want to do it so fast that you just want to go home. So,
okay.
Yeah. But I always find that it's always good that you get to do a lot of work and you know the business of the directing, and then maybe you have maximum time for your art, for your craft, you know, of directing. I find that a lot of maybe young directors will be, you are being sidelined. Most of the problem is actually the business of the directing, which is no time lah. Some people don't forget wardrobe lah, they forget lines.
Oh, okay.
All these things you will learn how to deal with all those things first. And then you will just take care of let's get a good performance, even though, like, you know, this thing happened, that thing happened, the rain, then we shift in. So, practice, like what you said, I think I really think that what you said about like you really did all the homework is a very good way of looking at shorts, because the even for me, I haven't done many shorts for a long time. But you're right, you know, you get to do your homework, then when you're finally doing your feature film, you sort of like sort that out. Nah. One thing is, how do you choose your DPs in your works? Are they mostly given, or like you like some filmmakers and then some DPs and then you start to talk to them, or you keep using the same DPs?
These days I kind of like work with the same DP a lot because his versatility. But actually, I always love to work with different DPs. Because personally, I think from earlier, like I tell you, even if I'm doing works, right, I try to work with different people as much as possible. So I don't get stuck in this thing for a number of reasons. First of all, for practical reasons, you know, sometimes certain production could not afford this DP that I want. Mm. That's one thing.
Mm.
Or maybe the DP is not free in a period of time. So to avoid being dependent on that. So I always try to work with as much DP as possible. The only criteria I always look for DP is like, I mean, their showreel is one thing, is to at least to talk to them first, because and see where they come from. But I'm kind of lucky because all the DP that I work with are kind of like very experienced. They got their own set of skills that I could work with. The most important thing is that they are, as long as they are willing to work with me. So that's the thing that I always worry about, because there's things like, you know, DP and the director have their own directions, you know, they see things differently, and sometimes you got a clash of ego on set. That's the thing that I try to avoid. But thank God, throughout my career, I have not met a DP like that. So a lot of DP that I work with, rather young or older than me, I kind of work with them I adapt to them, actually, in fact. I try to adapt to them. Like, what's their winning style? Mm-hmm. Because some DP will need all their lights.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll take like 1-2 hours to set up a scene. Whereas some DP will take 30 minutes to set up a scene. Now, if you ask me, I prefer the guy who set up the scene in 30 minutes. But sometimes if you don't get that, you have to work with a DP who set up a scene, 2 hours to set up a scene, and you have to do that. Because as a director, no matter how much I want him to go faster, I need to respect the way he works. And then on my time, then I need to, during pre-production, when I know this guy works like that, then I need to make sure my shots are more precise. I need to get all these shots. You know, I know I don't have time to do other shots if this guy's work in this place. Mm-hmm. So in a way, it doesn't sound like the director kind of like, they're adapting to me. So I adapt a lot to how they work. Okay. I think which is much more easier. And in a way, I get to see more distinct style from them rather than if they work with the way I work. Because most likely, if I force them to do to set up in 30 minutes like the other DPs, it'll look kind of most like same, I believe. Whereas if I let them set up the lights that they usually set up, maybe they could give me a new visual that I have not seen before. So I also look out for that. So that's still, that's why sometimes my films, right, the visual styles look a bit roger. Okay. Sometimes like very realistic, sometimes look very, very slick. That's because I have a different DP. So I kind of like work in that way, because I also think DPs are, if you give them a name, a term called director of photography, right?
Mm.
In a way, they are quite serious too. Right? They are director of the camera and visual. Mm. So I think in a way, I would respect them in that way. But of course, the final decision usually, I call the shot. If the things go too far out, right, or they take too long to set up the shot, then I have to come in and kind of like tell them, yeah, we're going to change the way we work, which happened before once, very long time ago. Yeah. Mm.
So,
right.
Talking about that, but Singapore is like a giant kampong. So,
what do you mean by the giant kampong?
So when we complain to the head, of the village, it normally gets hurt because it's not big like Malaysia.
okay.
Yeah, so easier to enforce and then like, you know.
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. But also, we're still learning. A lot of things we're still learning. It sounds like a more systematic thing, but sometimes being systematic and being creative may be very different things. What, I'm sure you've been to Singapore for film festivals, and I think you've seen a lot of Singaporeans. I think we're almost like the same country, but do you think there's a difference between Singapore filmmakers and Malaysian filmmakers?
Yeah, I think I can tell. I mean, based on the work, I wouldn't know how you guys work right on set. In the earliest days, early 2000, I think, in my opinion, a lot of them was very, I would say kind of like, maybe because it's still early days, a lot of them could tell they are still searching for their own identity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about Singaporean films.
Yep.
Yeah. But this past 10 years, I think that changed. Personally, I think the Singapore films, not the commercial mainstream films, I'm talking about those that went to festivals, you know, the Cannes, Taipei, the festivals, there's, and all this stuff, have matured quite a lot, you know. And actually, all the films are quite polished, in my opinion, compared to Malaysia films. That's my opinion. Maybe Malaysian won't agree with me. How they handle the subject. And actually I enjoy most of them that I watch. One of them is not a very young film girl, I believe it's a veteran film, Yellow Bird.
Rajat Gopal.
Yes, I like that film a lot. And eventually the Land of the Imagine, is it?
The Land of the Imagine, yeah.
Correct. So I could see, yeah, they're all kind of like arty, personal, you know, but those are the type of films that I like. But which I feel like they, these films are really more, to me, it's kind of more defined, you know, like they're more confident, like, oh, this is Singapore films, right? Compared to when it was early, you could still tell it's somewhere here and somewhere there, which I think is still kind of the same with Malaysia back then for the so-called indie filmmakers. We are finding our roots, right? It's not so well defined. But now I think, yeah, personally, I think Singapore films, they have matured, and the filmmakers are more trained, I think, because all of them have studied. Whereas compared to Malaysia, a lot of us, the film directors, we are self-taught, or we just happen to be in the industry. So I think we lack that basic foundation craft of cinema, which I always think is very important.
Okay.
Right? Everybody can pick a camera, you know, shoot a talking head, even a YouTuber can do it, right? And sometimes it looks really good. But I think what's lacked is the cinematic craft behind it, which I think most of these Singapore films that I've seen recently, that I like those two dimensions, they had that in there. It's quite hard to for me to say, how do you differentiate? Why do you think that cinematic compared to a YouTuber short films or TV? Because it's a feeling, you know, that sometimes you see certain films, you know, how it's shot. And most morning is the director's vision. You can see all their styles very distinctive.
Okay.
Whereas if you watch normal short films or TV series, they are all kind of, say, template, because they are meant to be that way.
I mean, it's very strange. It's always, you know, we always look at the other side, and then it's grass is always greener. But I really enjoyed, I think you're involved with it, is the Barbarian Invasion by Chewie.
Oh, okay.
I love that a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, so because I thought, I don't know, for me, I thought Malaysian films are more commercial, you know?
Oh, you think that? Okay, okay.
Yeah, so which, like, right, even Barbarian Invasion, but I can see it's like, oh, it can be very commercial. It's like, it's not too indulgent, right? Yeah, so I really like that. And other films also, I mean, even with your films, you know, I thought he has that, because once you say art film, it almost like, oh, okay, certain group of people to watch on it.
Because
The rest of the people are like, oh, I can't watch this. I can't watch like 3 minutes, that person not moving in the room. Yeah, so oversimplified, but then I think, in terms of an industry, like what you talk about, you know, your previous HVD, right?
Mm-hmm.
And even now your cinema market, I think it's definitely still more commercial. That means there are a lot more commercial work to be done. There's an audience. And for us, we still suffer from like a lot of films just get not watched at all, you know.
Mm.
And because our market is really so small. Right? And we don't have the advantage of like, you know, if it's a language specific market, then you still at least Malaysia, I think still can release something in, you know, in either, can you all release in Cantonese?
Yes, we can.
Oh, we can. So, and then, so Malay definitely, right?
Yep.
So I think that's the, to me, lah, I think that there was a lot more interesting, development in terms of filmmaking in the more commercial space in Malaysia. And also, we also see a lot of artists like y'all that do well. And over here, so we also still envy. That. So it's probably you guys looking at us and we also
maybe so.
Yeah. Which is very strange because we actually came from the same place, right? Until a few decades ago.
All right.
I mean, if you go other places, the first thing you gravitate is that you see a Malaysian, we're always grouped together.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So even though there's separation, but we have a lot of things that's quite similar, right? How important is getting a good producer partner for you? Or do you produce most of the things yourself?
I don't produce most of the thing myself, but I will always get a producer to help me. I think a good producer is something I lack of. And I think all film directors should have a very, very good producer who also know films, have a aesthetics taste, and also at the same time, very good with accounts and finance, which is getting rare these days because these days all the producers are very good in numbers. And that's the problem, right? It's about cost, profit. And the sad thing is that in Malaysia, some of these producers are still beginning to direct because they are so good in getting fundings, right? They don't see the need for a director, which is kind of crazy. So it's only in industry that's not very developed, things like this happen. I don't think it happened a lot in most developed industry because you're actually doing 2-3 jobs by the same person. There's a lot of clash of conflict, right?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't make sense. But in Malaysia, still, we do have that type of, which I think is a problem. Because the investor can't differentiate why this role needs to be separate, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The producer, other than what I've said, they have to have that, they also need to be kind of like very good with dealing with the director.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I always think that the producer have the most shittiest job in the whole line, you know, all this whole production, because they deal with money, networking, you know, liaising with everybody, making sure the film is finished on time with quality, and have to deal with the director who might go out of control. So it's a highly stressful job, and I think that's why not much people want to become a producer. They're not very glamour, is it? Nobody like give a shit about producer in terms of like from the ordinary people point of view, right?
Yep.
They always talk about director, the actors, right? I kind of like pity that producers are not being appreciated. Mm. Hence, I think that's why we lack of good producers. Like me, I definitely had a hard time finding a good producer for the past 6-7 years.
Mm-hmm.
When I freelance, I don't have to worry about that because the producers usually come from the production company.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and they're usually quite experienced. But when I'm trying to do my own things, I'm having a bit of challenge trying to find a producer who could kind of like come on board, help me, you know, secure funding, talk to investors, and put the whole project together. Mm. So a lot of times, a lot of the prepping work of a deck or a concept is done on my own before a producer who's interested, they will come in a bit later, which I always think that a producer should come in very early to help guide the concept, pitch, everything, which personally I think I lack of, which I think because the industry, we lack producers who's interested in coming in that early. They're more interested in coming in when there's money.
Okay. The other thing is, what about producing after the movie is made, like the marketing, going to festivals and all that? So do you find that that is very necessary nowadays?
Yes, I still think it's necessary depending on your genre of film. I still do it on my own when I don't have a producer. But this day, there's producers who do that too. You know, a number of them, which I know, they will help the films to submit to festival, because submitting to festival is quite a hassle. That's a lot of work. Even though with internet, right? The forms, everything, you know, the liaising and all this stuff. I think it's important depending on the film you're making. If it's a small indie film, whether it's a genre or a horror film, I think the festivals and the markets matters. Like for instance, for me in Malaysia, if you're doing a Malay commercial films, then that's not a necessary thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then they will just do the normal A&P to bombard it to the mass audience, you know, through their TV, ads, press, social media, radio, right? That's, I think, the most important thing, which is, I think, is more challenging and harder than comparing to marketing in a festival.
Mm-hmm.
Because to market a commercial film costs way more.
Yep.
Even in one country. Yeah.
So do you produce some of your work, or most of it you just direct?
Most of it I just direct. I always got in a producer who also double as line producer for my short films.
Yeah.
I only produce when mainly if once in a while my short films.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wouldn't produce a long form on my own. It is quite taxing.
Mm.
Yeah. But I do produce for other filmmakers a couple of years back.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But now I kind of like put it on hold for a while because financial matters, because it costs time and a little bit of money when I produce for other filmmakers.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I would talk to as many filmmakers as possible or directors as possible. Then we get a sense of like what a director does. And everyone's answer, even though most of the questions I'm asking you is the same, everyone answers differently, right? So what do you think are the invisible things now as a more experienced director that you think for a new filmmaker they need? What kind of invisible things? Like, learn how to do the festival route, or like learn to get a producer, or like watch films, or what do you think would be the invisible things that kind of people didn't know, you know, directing needs to know, that you know, now with hindsight that maybe you thought, like for me it would be like working with a producer. Most of the things I've done have been I produced myself, so okay. Yeah, and it stunts also my directing career. Also, you know, especially when you grow older, then it's very hard for any young producer to attach. Because obviously with age, normally the producers always grow with the director. So they normally come from the film school together, right?
Okay.
That's the typical way. But what do you think would be the invisible skills that a young filmmaker would need to be successful as a director?
It depends on what the young filmmakers are trying to achieve, because some so-called director, they would be clueless on what to do on the set, but they'll still get a lot of jobs or projects because they're good in marketing. We call them salesmen. They're very good in socializing. That's the truth. Right. And you can tell by their work, it's like, how did they get the money to do this a lot, especially these days? So it really depends, because there's a skill that I would love to have, right? But it's not easy, because it's got to do with personalities, right? It's something built into the character. You can look at a lot of books on how to sales and market yourself, all this stuff. If a person does not behave like that, it's hard to, you know, some people have very thick skin and they're very good. And I think that's something that I don't have, right? And that's one direction for a filmmaker to go, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because eventually everything is just about money. For those who truly want to be a director who knows the craft, then I would recommend you have to work in all the posts for at least 1 or 2 years before you start directing. I think it's very important because filmmaking is the only so-called art form that involves so many others discipline. Right? So if you talk about oil painting, if you like it or not, you need to make your hands dirty. You need to have to mix the color yourself and paint that oil onto this canvas. But in filmmaking, somehow people think like, oh no, if I direct, I don't need to know how to operate the camera because I got this guy, right? Which I think is a big mistake because you don't hire a guy will hold your brush to help paint the oil painting. For artists, right? For a musician, you don't ask the guy to play the piano with you. You know, you still need to have to play the piano before you compose, and then you hire somebody else to play it. But you still need to know how to arrange. But to know how to arrange the music, you need to know how to play the instruments. So I think filmmaking is one thing because it involves so many things. Especially I think a young director should focus on editing and camera work, that become a DP for a short while. If you want to at least minimize the things that you want to focus on, these two I would think is a good way to help you before you become a director. And the third one is become an AD. Assistant directing is good. If you work as an AD for a lot of different directors, then you can tell who's good directors, who's like a con man, who have like, God, this is not directing. Because eventually you can see more style. You can start to understand what's directing about. So it's no good if you just AD for one director, then you kind of stuck in that bubble like, oh, this is how director should be. So I was kind of lucky because I did AD a lot during the period when I was ADing for these funky directors. And so after that, I AD a lot for commercials. So for some Australian directors and all this, so I could see all the different stuff. The fact that directing is very organic thing. You can't pinpoint how one should make, but that's the process that you need to go through.
Okay.
The preparation, right? So I think for instance, a director should at least understand the lens. The lens, like what this lens do, and at least you should understand the shots. Why do you need these shots? And to understand why you need shots, you need to learn editing. Because I think today we still have directors who shoots like 360 degree, which quite well known. They'll cover every goddamn thing, top shot, every shot for one simple scene, right? I don't think that's directing. I mean, even a janitor could do that, right? If you do a job and you cover all your base, like, you know, if you want to invest in a stock market, but you try to cover all the base, I mean, everybody can do that. So it doesn't make sense. The reason why there's a profession like doctor, lawyer, and filmmakers, we are the one who make those precise decisions. There's a risk involved. By the time you cover everything, I mean, everybody could do that job. So that's, that I don't think is a very skillful director, which I don't think even is directing. It's quite crazy to shoot like that. You just exhaust the actors, waste all time. Directors being, I feel like, to know what you want, you know, and how to get there, how to get your team to shoot it, and get the shots you want, so at least you got the things that you eventually you have planned, you know, through pre-pro and script. That's what a director should do. And I think when a young filmmaker who becomes a director without being editor or DP or AD, they will immediately like have this vision in their mind. Okay, I want this shot. But how do you tell these people how to execute this shot? Or at least like, what's the point of this shot? And I think because of lack of these skills, which I think is communication skill, and so lack of understanding on cinema language, where's the craft? So they can't talk properly, and then everybody's like confused, and then there's a lot of ego. And you know, I think that's the problem. A lot of the young directors doesn't even know how to communicate in the film language that they're supposed to work in. Like, okay, I need a 2-shot wide, right? And how to block the actors. Blocking is a little one big problem, man. I found a lot of, I could tell by looking at the work, a lot of time they do not know how to block the actors. So they just block it just because like they don't know what to do with it. Because I think blocking itself is a technique for flow.
Yeah.
So it helps to convey meaning, message, and things that you want to show the audience. So I guess my suggestion would be, if you want to focus on things that before they become directing, editing, DPing, and ADing, these three, I think it's a good place to learn. Yeah.
Very, very detailed advice, because I totally agree. I mean, I like it that you first said editing, because a lot of times, a lot of people ask me about my directing, is it actually comes from editing. Because in the editing, then you can see, wow, the directing, a lot of things was wrong, or like, wow, you didn't have that shot. You don't have that shot. And then you're like, hey, how come this one is so slow? Then this, it's very fast that you can see how you can be faster on set. And also, you know, better when you, at the final part about, you know, editing it and getting the shot that you want.
Correct.
Yeah. So I like that. The DPing one, I also agree. But I also talk to a lot of directors that just say, okay, that's another department and it's a partnership that they want to have with the other person. So you don't fill in all the blanks, that person will fill in the blank. I also get it. But also, as I said, I shoot myself and sometimes when there's no money. When I started to become like sort of like a DP, you know, and then you sort of like, it tells me about how to become a better director. So it works both ways. That means like, I also see is like when I'm DPing, then I can see how to become a better director. And then as a director, also I can see how I can help the DP, if there's a DP, to tell a story better. Finally, the AD part, that part I didn't grow into, but I can see how also in Singapore, especially, a lot of DP, a lot of ADs, almost half of the ADs I meet wants to be a director, which is a good thing, but half are not interested. So they are like good in logistics and pushing the time and like a floor manager. They're good in that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I always tell a lot of ADs that there's a big difference between I can see that you want to be a storyteller AD or you want to be a floor manager AD, because, you know, so it's good. Those three jobs will be a good part to be in your journey to become a better director. I think that's good, very good advice. For you, when you start to shoot your short films, was not by choice, or you decide to shoot it yourself? Or there was no choice? It's like, okay, I ask these friends from theater to shoot, and then of course I'm the one shooting because we're not going to spend money. Or so why did you take up the camera in the beginning?
I think that's the best way to find out whether it works or not. To you know, because my earlier short films I DP'd myself too. I was holding a camera. I think that's the best way to learn for anything that involves craft, right? That's why I kind of like very surprised that a lot of filmmakers, when they make their first feature length film, they totally dump short films as it like that stepping stone, which I think that's totally really like stupid, right? To me, because I think filmmaking is a craft, it's an art form. Whether you're doing a commercial film, even a corporate video or TBC, there's a form involved, right? No doubt there's a craft in it, right? No matter sometimes how bad it turns out, it's a language in that, except it's a service now. And I think the best way to practice is always you do it on your own, because I kind of like always compare filmmaking to martial arts. Right? The only way you can be good in martial arts or a good fighter, MMA fighter, you got to constantly practice. Right? Those guys train very hard, right? And then they fight a lot of small fights before they fight the big fights. And when they fight the big fights, they are ready. To me, filmmaking is like that. I need to constantly upgrade myself and try different things in a short film. In fact, that's why if you ever watch my short films, they are quite varied. The genre, the storytelling, they're a bit here and there, because I'm experimenting. You know, I just want to try whether it works or not. You know, like I said, I wouldn't want to try this in a feature film, right? You're talking about like more cost and more time, and then if it doesn't work, it's a waste of time. So I was taught short film is a good way to practice. You know, you hone your skill, you learn the good, and then you see like, oh, this doesn't work. Then you try not to do it again. Then when I'm doing, that's why I'm not sure about other filmmakers, but I always get this a lot from actors or fellow filmmakers when they know I'm about to shoot a feature length film. Like even recently, I've done one Malay action films. We're still in post. It's our local firefighters. It's considered big by Malaysia standard. They would look at me and I seem calm, you know, because I got a feeling like most directors would be stressed out with that amount of pain. They will always ask, oh, why are you not like stressed? Why are you so calm and all this stuff? Even some actors sometimes they ask me that, you know, when we're shooting, they're like, James, why are you so calm? The thing is, I've told them, like, I've done all my homework. That's the reason I'm calm. And as a director, I cannot be nervous, dude, because I'm leading you guys. So I think the worst director is like, first, you look nervous and on set. And second, the biggest problem is like, you do not know what you want on set. And usually it's a telltale sign like, oh shit, this director is fairly new or you have no experience. And this is where I think a lot of time you waste, the production wastes a lot of time trying to figure out what the hell the director wants. And in order to be confident and I think to be calm and direct, I think that preparation work, which I think back to like, you know, if you're an MMA fighter, that 2 weeks of training for the final fight is intense. It's just about every day, drilling, you know, training, looking at the script, finding a point to make sure this is all things that I want and how I'm going to achieve it. So on set, basically, I'm just there to get the shot I want, which is something that I think not much people would agree, because I thought a film is always being made during pre-production, not the principal shooting. Principal shooting is for you to get the shot that you already planned. So you don't waste so much time, because principal shooting is the period that costs a lot, right? Because a lot of people on set, your food, you know, your location. So films are being made during pre-production, you know, your storyboards, all this stuff, your rehearsals. And principal shooting is for you to, I mean, for a filmmaker to go get the shot that you want. If you've got some extra time, do some coverage, try something. If not, you're going to move on. And I think that is also because of my background working with Hong Kong directors, because they are very efficient. They rarely get stuck in the middle of a shoot, you know, unless there's problem in the script or they're waiting for a script. Because last time the script still being sent in from Hong Kong through fax and they are waiting for the scene. Those happens, so director can't do much. But otherwise, they don't stop. They just keep the momentum going on. Rarely they will stop and stuck there for like 1 hour trying to figure out what happened, unless it's a weather or things that are not under the production control. So I think that's a very important thing for me. The preparation needs to be very, very detailed. And I need to be able to answer to most people. So this is one thing why I think directing is not easy. I need to know a bit more than the rest of the HOD.
Yeah, that's very true. I think for me, I think the training came from TV. I do a lot of TV. So maybe it's a bit like your days.
As in series? You do series also? Yeah.
So...
Oh, okay.
Which I always tell a lot of young directors is that, of course, a lot of people also hate TV directors because they say, oh, it's the same coverage, it's the same things, right? But I notice is that those people who do TV has worked out the day's business for a director. Like what you said, you know, meeting the time, making sure that everything is done. All those things are the first thing you learn because... And that's the business of a director, because I find a lot of, you can be a very good director if you take this scene to take 3-4 days to do. Of course, you have the time, right?
Yeah, everybody's going to be good, man.
Yeah, but if you're like, what, 20 scenes a day for us?
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe we can start with like, how do you begin? Because I look at your bios and then you started actually with theater. So how do you begin this filmmaking journey?
Okay, there's a long story, but since it's a long podcast, I actually started as a graphic designer back in the, I think, early 90s. The film industry totally was virtually, I'd say, non-existent, except for those Malay commercial movies. So there's no like rare Chinese movies. Movies of not in Malay language is very rare. And it's very hard to go into the industry. It's very, I think, very mystery. You know, it's like a mysterious thing. Okay. In those days, you don't know how films are being made. So the closest thing was theater, you know, where I thought, oh, this is fun. At least it's, you can get to work with actors and learn about directing, you know, and script and stuff. without actually knowing that one day there'll be a chance to go into the TV and film industry. Because back in those days, I think for normal, ordinary people like me, right, when you watch a movies like in a cinema, you have no idea how they made it. It's just like you. For me and my friends at the time, it was like, wow, it's going to be very hard, difficult to make films, right? We still do, which I think is still involve a lot of craft other than funding. And I think right after that, when I'm not sure if you've heard of HVD, it's called Home Video Distributor. It used to distribute a lot of TVB's video tapes in Malaysia, right?
Oh, wow.
The biggest. And then they go into productions. To kind of like, they started their own production to produce our own local Chinese and Malay content, dramas. Last time it's called dramas. There's no word for such a content.
Yeah.
And then they branched off to Tamil language dramas.
Okay.
And this is during the mid-90s, I think. And they brought in a lot of Hong Kong's writers, producers, and directors. And once in a while, they're bringing Hong Kong actors to kind of like star as the main actors in the series, you know, then with the local actors as supporting. So there's a bit of like craft and technology transfers in this whole process. And that's how I got it started into TV.
Okay.
In fact, it's from theater to TV. And everything went fine until 97. I think the Asian financial crisis. And the whole company just went stagnant. And eventually, now it's still around, I believe, but it was no longer producing, not as in the great heydays where... When I was working there as a PA and eventually AD, assistant director, they have like 30 projects going on per day.
Wow.
Yeah, it's crazy. And I think that was one of the cause we believe why it actually fell right after the 97 crisis, because they overproduced. Because a lot of dramas they were producing, expecting the station to buy it.
Mm.
Yeah, so they overproduce. The office area was back in Cheras, in KL. They bought in like two office block, like the whole block of rows of shops with the post there, their wardrobe, they got their own warehouse for art. So they're running in, they were trying to emulate a TVB.
Oh, so it's almost like a studio like that.
Yes, it's a proper studio system. It was very well run. I think it's the best place to learn directing for camera. Right, working with, shooting with camera and all this stuff. And the whole place looked like a little Hollywood back then, before the whole thing come crashing down. The hawkers, the restaurants were all making a lot of money because every morning, that's where all the crews, directors and actors eat, you know, then. And to be honest, back in those days, it looks weird to be in the industry because everybody in those HOD role are doing very well. They're driving like nice cars. I'm not sure if you know about Honda Civic, they got that hatchback last night.
Yeah.
That was a cool car in the mid-90s, you know, hatchback two doors. Everybody wanted it once. It's not cheap. And some of them got it from Japan, right? And you got a cameraman driving those, you know, you got directors buying houses.
Wow.
And I was young. Yeah, I was young then. I was like, wow, this is great. Even PM makes a lot of money, so production managers, right? Because back in those days, they count, they make their money off per episodes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So everybody was making big money. Until 97, everything came crashing down and I was kind of like jobless for a while. From 97 to 2000, I was freelancing. That's where I started to branch off like in editing, doing camera work, DPing, and sometimes ADing. It took me about like in 2001 or two, where I got my first chance to direct a magazine show.
Okay.
So, yeah. So it was hard to direct back those days. Nobody will give you the... let you direct narrative drama or deal with actors. That end of this, you need a recommendation from a director that you work with or a producer that worked with you for a long time. Then they will recommend you to direct. And the problem was like after 97, a lot of the Hong Kong directors that I worked with, they all went back. Either went back to Hong Kong, some went to Singapore, and some immigrated to Canada. So there was no more people that could recommend me. The industry was kind of like restarting again. So I have to kind of like restart again. So when I got a first gig, I think it was a magazine program. And it was for like 1 or 2 years doing corporate videos, magazine program, some reality shows, interviews, before I got a chance to direct a drama narrative.
Okay.
That's how I got started.
Okay. But very interesting is that I also was in advertising and graphics because last time I also got no film school. So the nearest thing was actually doing graphic design. So I also came from there in the 90s and all that. But we didn't have such a nice system like what you're saying.
HVD.
HVD, right? So yeah. I assume when you said that everybody was making a lot of money is because the films was also making a lot of money?
Yes, the series are being bought over by our state-owned or state-backed national TV, RTM, Radio Television Malaysia.
Okay.
So there was like a guaranteed revenue until everything. You know, in Malaysia, right, every time there's a change of government, the whole business environment changed. And it depends on who they were connected to. And I think that was how they got into trouble back then.
And that time was a lot of the revenue came from either, was it VCD or like, you know, buying those VHS tapes or that? Or it's just TV?
HVD, they were big because they distribute VHS. They were not in the VCD or DVD market. So I think they made a large part of their revenue selling the series to RTM. And once in a while, I think they tried to sell it back to China or Hong Kong back in the 90s. So I think by producing and selling it out, so they don't sell it to retail, like direct to customers.
Yeah. Okay. And the type of genre that you were doing as PM or even AD was, what kind of genre productions were you involved?
I was involved in predominantly Malay series before I got a chance to do some Chinese series. Basically, they are like the TVB series, family drama, love, you know, family fighting over inheritance. the normal stuff that I think is still being done today. And they kind of like, actually most of the script in the early days was from Hong Kong. Then they translate it to Bahasa, the Malay, and then some to Tamil. They adapt a lot first before they start producing their own. So I think what's good about that was there's a real skill transfer during that period. Because as the Hong Kis was here running the production, they start a script workshop. They were trying to train a lot of local scriptwriters. And a few of them actually are still around, like writing for feature films. I think it was actually quite sad that it actually
stopped.
It just went down. Okay. Yeah.
The other thing is that when you were PMing or ADing at that time, let me reframe the question, is that because they were sort of like most of the creatives come from Hong Kong, do you think this beginning sort of like mold you into what kind of filmmaker you are now? Like, is there a like Hong Kong sensibility to your films?
Yes, in fact, I think I wouldn't say Hong Kong sensibility because we watch a lot of Hong Kong films back in those, right?
Yeah.
It automatically seeps into our mind and blood. But what I learned is like the way they work. I think that's one thing I can confidence to say that these days a lot of young directors doesn't have that skill to match Hong Kong directors. I'm not so sure about Singapore, but I think a lot of young directors these days, they don't work under directors long enough. Yeah, there's no mentorship. I was AD for a couple of Hong Kong directors for like 3 or 4 years before the whole thing came crashing down.
Okay.
And I got to learn a lot from the good ones. Because back in those days, what we know is that some of the Hong Kong directors who came here, they're actually not directors in Hong Kong.
Okay.
Yeah, they're like art director, producer, or somebody who wanted to be director. And just because they are honky, they were recruited as director. And that's how I found out, like, there's a difference. Those that's really good directors, they are actually real directors. They got a really good way of working, very systematic. And one thing I noticed, at least I'm lucky, the guy I was with, I only remember his name called Michael, of course, surname. He's the only first Hong Kong director that I worked with as an AD that doesn't scream or yell. Because we kind of know Hong Kong directors are really like, they always shout, scream, yell, curse, you know, that's their culture. And we thought that is a way to direct. Until I was following Michael, which is kind of closer to what I thought directing should be like. Because in theatre, directing was very different. Right? Yeah, you don't often shout or scream. there's a lot of discussion and a lot more like a culture process. Like there's a culture and thing involved. Whereas in TV, back in the day, it was like a hard labor. Yeah, it was like a factory. Mm. Until I was working under this guy called Michael, and I kind of learned a lot from him. And the only thing I remember of him is like he is Wong Kar Wai, man.
Okay.
Yeah, and I love him, man. I love Wong Kar Wai. So we always have this discussion, and he say, you know, yeah, that was a funny thing about him. Yeah, so I learned a lot from him. I found out like he's fast, and he knows how to direct actors and direct the shot. Very different than the rest of the directors that I work with, and somehow I learned a lot from him as a director directing TV.
Okay, so. It's the same over here, even Singapore, for a lot of TV, especially Mandarin production. A lot of them came from Hong Kong also. So, and the beginning styles, I think in the 80s and all that, was like what you said, you know, there was a lot of shouting, a lot of belittling each other to performance, and then a lot of vulgar words. It's kind of the same, but we still have a lot of... sort of like from the Hong Kong era, and then they are now still part of the TV system, but they all changed because nobody would survive with that kind of culture. But the shooting style and all that is really something that I think even for our Channel 8 is still the same from what I heard. The way they shoot, the efficiency, the kind of style and all that, it's also still borrowed from them in the old days. Yeah. So what, after this, how did you, like, after that, then you decide to, how do you make your first film or first short and first film?
I started making my own short film first, even before I got to direct in the industry, you know, those magazine show I was telling you about. So from 97 to 2000, I managed to save up to buy a Sony camcorder, a Hi8. I'm not sure if you've heard of it.
Yeah, of course. Mm.
Yeah, it is before mini digital video, so it's a bigger tape.
Yeah.
And they were quite expensive. So I saved up about like 3K to buy the camera because it's a used camera.
Mm.
And start shooting my short films. Sadly, they are not around anymore because they are in that format. I couldn't find a way to digitize them. My earlier short films, they are very, very influenced by Wong Kar Wai and Quentin Tarantino.
Cool.
Yeah, there's this very too strong influence in my earlier short films. Even the style, the story, you know, it's gangster, assassin, you know, depressed killers talking to himself, all this stuff. Young filmmakers, we all go through that. So that's how I got to start. There was no festival then. So it was just making it for fun, showing in film club. Showing in screenings that's organized by people in Malaysia, very small screenings. Sometimes you got like 10, 20 people to watch, which is a very different era. It got me continue to make the films on my own, short film. That's why until these days, except for the last few years, I continue to make short films because I think I like the process. To me, the short film making is more like a sketchbook. Before I do my painting, like that thing with the oil painting, I think sketches are very important to keep myself learning. And most important thing is for me to try things before I try it in a feature film.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's better to have a 5-minute bad film than a 90-minute really, really bad film.
Okay. I didn't start filmmaking that early. So I started only in 2000, mid-2000s. So at that time, I think if you were to ask actors, you know, to do it for free, I think still can. So how was it filmmaking then? Was like, oh, just call some friends and then just do it together? Or how do you get your actors?
I think there's the difference. I think I always suspect in Singapore it's harder to do what we do here because, I mean, your place is expensive. Everybody get to work to survive. we have a lot of friends. Even if the actors are not friends, we approach them. They see our work. We meet if they like us. A lot of time they do it for free, and sometimes they do it for a token, which is nothing, and we provide the meal. Until today, I'm not sure, but I need to at least for me, if today I need to make a short film, I still can get some of the actors or my friends to help me out just for fun, because that's the only plus thing I feel what I've managed to achieve throughout the years is they could see me consistently making short films. So I'm kind of serious of what I'm doing. Mm. And I think most actors and people, when you want them to work as a favor, right, they need to see that consistency and the seriousness of the director, you know? Okay. And usually, like, a lot of people will try to work for the first time, and if they find out it's not really enjoyable, they won't do it the next time. But I'm kind of lucky because today I still could get leverage to get people to help me. If I want to do a short film for like 1 or 2 days, you know, no budget, I think a lot of them will help me. As long as they are free, they have nothing to do, right? They will help me. I think this type of stuff, it needs to be consistent. So it's not like you suddenly want to make a big short films after 5 years and you try to get people to work for free. That's, I think, it's harder, because then the actors or the crew will ask, like, what have you been doing before that, right? They couldn't see that progress of your work. So I think the good thing about when a filmmaker consistently making short film, you build a reputation, because people can see, oh, this guy kind of consistent, he's a bit crazy, he's still making short films. But, you know, let's have fun. Because I think a lot of actors who participate, they just want to try out new things, which usually they can't in a proper shoot, right? Because in a TV series, commercial, and feature film, there's a objective that you need to achieve. Whereas in the short film, even though they have to perform based on my need, but the short film itself has a more bigger creative space depending on the genre and the story.
Okay. Of course, for you, I mean, you're one of the very well-known filmmakers in Malaysia. But was it difficult in the beginning? That means, like, when you didn't have your reputation yet and then ask people to shoot for you and all, was it difficult then?
No, because I came from theatre.
Ah, see.
So I have a lot. That's why my earlier works, most of them are theatre actors or okay. theatre performers. Mm. Some of them are not even actors, but they are like theatre stage managers or lighting designer. Mm. So I just asked them, hey, you know, so it was good. So the theatre's network helped me. A lot of the actors, performers, they came and helped me. Mm. So you've got lighting designer for stage coming onto a film set and try to help me light my short film. So. Mm.
Okay, cool. I'm not looking at them. I'm just looking at notes.
Okay. Okay.
So when did you know that you were good in directing? That means like maybe your first short film or like the second short, or when it goes to a festival, then you're like, oh, okay, I'm doing quite okay in this line, or I don't mind, or like, no. So when do you know you were good in directing?
I wouldn't know I'm good at directing. I wouldn't say that. But I think what I know was like the craft itself is something I would love to do like for the rest of my life, even though if it's not a professional work, right? Because over the years, I think I'm even not sure now these days if I'm good in what I'm doing. So a lot of times people ask, oh, how do I say it? I keep telling, I'm still constantly learning. So I don't think I'll ever say, oh, I know I'm good. But I will know my work is decent or bad by when it's finished, when it's done. Okay. I mean, that I think this is locked, right? And then you see the finished product, it's like, oh, I should have done this. Those are easier to say. But to say, when did I notice I'm good at directing, I wouldn't know. But I would say when I'm confident in directing, it's like in my after I did all these magazine shows, when I was directing actors like for proper production for TV, yeah, I think at that time I was confident to direct. I wouldn't say good, I was confident, because I think what most directors need is confidence. It's not ego, because it's two different things. Ego is like, I always felt like they want to just prove their director they are right all the time. Whereas I think confidence is like, for me, I'm confident enough to work with an actor, but also confident enough to tell them sometimes, I don't know, what's this about, or what's the character thinking about, and I will need the actor's input to tell me what do they think of a character? So I think I work kind of in that man that way from the start because of theater. So okay. In theater, what I get from is a very collaborative process throughout the rehearsals process, which I managed to brought with me throughout my years of directing to be open up, create a space for actors to feel like they could, you know, discuss and talk with the directors. I think it's about more of like building trust with the actors.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Then that's a good answer. And what kind of material excites you to like do the next job? What kind of material do you look for?
To earn a living.
besides those kind of work, like, besides those kind of...
These days, I think it's quite wary because I do have a lot of stories that I want to make or shoot as a short film or feature film. Mm. I don't have a specific genre or story that I always like say I need to make. Like now I got a couple and they are quite wary. You know, I got an action thriller. I got a semi-art house drama that's I'm trying to develop. It depends on which ones get picked up or get investment. Otherwise, they'll just be there. For me, it's more like, I don't actually can nail down how I move on to the next thing until I got a theme or a story or idea that I want to develop. For instance, like now I'm working on a concept about cult. In Malaysia, right? I've been developing it for quite a while. It's not like all the while I'm interested in cult. It's only the past 5-6 years.
Mm.
Yes, and so because of some of the people that I know around my network, they actually fell victim to it in Malaysia, right? Mm. I mean, basically, I think it's everywhere. So that caught my interest. So I was developing this for quite a while. I hope we could get it made. If not, then yeah, I'll just put it aside. And then wait until the next subject come. Like now, I've been telling people I kind of like want to do this story in Singapore. Because everyone asks if I want to shoot anything in Singapore. Which I recently watched some CNN stuff about this. People who clean up houses of the dead people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is quite common in Japan and Korea. Mm. But now it looks like Singapore too. You know, a lot of these are old people who dies alone.
Mm.
And then they kind of like rot because they are discovered after a few days.
Mm-mm-mm.
And there's this Malay man and his daughter who clean up these places for living.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so I thought that was a cool idea that I would love to develop one day if that's a opportunity. Yeah.
Okay. So you have never shot anything over here?
Mm-hmm. Personally, no. But in terms of like working with agency, yes, I shot like two of them in Singapore.
Okay. Is there a difference between the crew in Malaysia and Singapore?
Okay. I can't tell because the things that I shot in Singapore for the agency, they were all mainly a Malaysian crew.
Okay.
But yeah, they actually want us to get a Malaysian HOD to come here and then with a Singaporean support on the job. So I don't have a chance to actually work with a fully Singaporean crew before. So I'm not sure about that. But in terms of working conditions, sadly to say, Singapore is much more professional than Malaysia.
Okay.
I mean, you got to trust me on that because I got friends from Singapore who always thought I just kind of, you know, you always trash back your own country because you're from a country.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's true because it took him a while to find out about the situation here. Because we are still not very professional how we run our professions. Still very Western cowboy. You know, there's no system. I don't know how Singapore do it, but, you know, they got overtime, you got double pay, you got a lot of things that seems like there's no union in Singapore, right?
No. In fact, all those things didn't happen maybe 10 years ago. So it's also quite new that, you know, you know, Singapore very good in complaining, so somehow.
But it gets things done. I don't know, like even the actors I read on Facebook posts, right? Like they being owed the last payment not getting paid.
Then
they complain to, I think, IMDA, is it Singapore?
Yeah.
And they kind of like help and then they got their payment. So yeah. I guess there's some sort of enforcement or people, bigger entity that help to make sure people are not being exploited, you know?